Hi, this is Bill Indicke for the Streets.mn podcast, conversations about transportation, public space, and urban design in the Twin Cities. This week's podcast is a conversation with Michael Fallon, executive director of the Minneapolis Television Network and a longtime arts writer in the Twin Cities. Michael has an article in the recently released issue, Public Arts Review, all about creative placemaking, one of the hottest ideas in urban design and public art. We met up last week at Sweeney's Saloon in St. Paul's Dale Street to talk all about the history of the idea of place, some of the challenges of public art, and how concepts like creative placemaking can potentially become meaningless urban planning buzzwords. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Let's just start. Okay. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm good, Bill.
Welcome to the podcast. We're here today with Michael Fallon, who is the... Tell me your proper title.
Executive Director of the Minneapolis Television Network.
Yeah, and you've just started this job, and it's
It's been a little
exciting.
Bit over 3 months.
Seems like 3 weeks.
Seems like three years. No, it's been good getting up to speed. It's an organization that was in crisis, so it's been putting out a lot of fires, and we're in the middle of it. And if I look a little tired, it's because I am.
Yeah.
Today and yesterday and tomorrow, I'll be in the face of a couple of city council members in Minneapolis.
Oh, yeah. So to get people caught up on that, that's the Public Access Network for Minneapolis.
Public Access Center and Station, the channels on the Comcast network for the city of Minneapolis.
What number of the channels? What's the number?
The channel numbers are channel 16, 17, and 75 on the Comcast network.
Now, I've never had cable in my entire life, so I don't really understand what you're talking about personally.
Well, you just as we were in our pre-interview discussion, you were talking about two movies that have public access shows, so you do kind of understand.
Wayne's World and UHF
World,
that's not what your job is like.
No,
like,
it is.
So you're the producer in Wayne's World, who's the bad guy, played by... what is his name?
Rob Lowe.
Rob Lowe
was in there.
Rob Lowe.
I remember that. The producer was the best. Well, yeah, that's a little unrealistic. I mean,
Rob Lowe.
Public access was a way to create a venue for people in the community to create media that would go on the Comcast network.
Right.
And so people can get up to speed. They can learn how to produce television shows using modern equipment and editing equipment. And they can produce shows, and they can put them on the air for very, very, very cheap.
Actually, I've actually read...
For the price of a few lunches at McDonald's.
Right.
That's it. I mean, it's per year, you pay $40 to be a member of our organization, and you can put as many shows as you want on that we have room for on the air.
I remember reading a book. I was really interested in media policy and media studies a number of years ago. Rich Media, Poor Democracy. Have you read that book? It's kind of about the birth of... public radio and radio in America, and how they had to choose between having a more public model and a privately run model, and there was this big debate in the 20s about that, and the U.S. went the private model, and kind of public broadcasting in general has been under fire since then, as opposed to other countries where it's more legitimated by kind of the economic structure of the media.
Sure.
Although I think it's under fire everywhere. I'm not going to be naive about it.
Yeah.
Right? But so it seems like cable access is part of that model for cable TV in particular. Like the deal was, okay, you can have access to this structure of our public sort of broadcasting, you know.
But the deal was when it became apparent that cable companies were are going to be a reality, and they were organizing in cities across America, and they were negotiating for the right of way to put up cable lines and be able to connect houses.
So physical right of way, like
the physical right of way to be able to put up the lines, to be able to establish the cable networks. The federal government, there were a bunch of people who petitioned the federal government to say, hey, this is public right-of-way. You're giving this free public space away to these companies. So, we should bring something back to the public. So the federal government passed a law that said you have to create public channels on these cable networks, and you have to pay for it. Actually, the subscribers essentially pay for these channels to exist. And now we are 30 years down the road, and it's all, you know, the media landscape is fragmented and scattered to the winds, and it's all very much up in the air because the cable company is just saying, tell me again why we have to do this, you know, when you have satellite TV and you have online TV and all these formats that don't have
or YouTube.
The same.
YouTube is an amazing thing, right? Yeah. It didn't exist 6 years ago or 8 years ago or whatever.
Right. So and it's an interesting world to be in right now because everything's very much in flux.
Yeah.
And so that's my job. That's what I'm working on.
Okay.
Protecting the rights of the Wayne's Worlds of the world to go
so
on air.
What are like some shows that are on MTN?
Well, the most famous one is Viva and Jerry's Country Videos.
Okay.
So it's just two people have been doing it for 21 years. They're in their late 60s. They're a couple, Viva and Jerry, in their late 60s, early 70s. And they basically goof off and talk about stuff and then show country music videos.
That sounds great.
Yeah. And then there's a lot of sort of community affairs talk shows, of course. You know, like, a lot like KFAI.
Yeah, where I volunteer at KFAI for a long time, so I know all about
KFAI
that.
Radio. Yeah. We do the TV side of community media. And,
yeah, so there was a show that I saw one time. I didn't have cable, but it was somehow made it onto the internet, where a guy played Scrabble with callers.
Oh, yeah.
Is that a real thing?
It's a
real
thing.
I thought that was cool.
Yeah, that was Hamill... Griffin Cassidy, who was a former employee of MTN, who set that up.
Okay.
He's a brilliant guy.
I liked that a lot.
He's still friends with the organization, but he left some months ago to pursue other things, but we're hoping we can work with him more.
And then there was, like, he did karaoke too, right? Like, you call in karaoke?
I don't know about that one. That one I haven't heard about.
I think that happened.
It was before my time, and so was the Scrabble show, but I have seen clips of it, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you set it up. It's pretty basic technology, but you have phone in, and then you have set up two cameras.
Yeah.
One to show the letters you have, and one to show the board. And so he was actually really playing Scrabble with the city of Minneapolis.
You know, honestly, this kind of is almost art, right? If you're playing Scrabble with the city of Minneapolis, and that's kind of what we're here to talk about today, because a second ago, right before we started broadcasting, Michael, you opened up this envelope containing the latest edition of Public Art Review, right?
Yes, the Virgin issue.
Which you've just seen for the first time here, and it's what month is that, December?
Well, they do, I think it's
quarterly?
Quarterly.
Yeah, okay.
Well, this is fall, winter, so I think they do three issues two issues a year.
Yeah.
And so this just came out. It just came out a week ago.
Yeah, and you haven't seen it before. But inside is an article that you wrote about placemaking and kind of the role that public art has in cities.
Well, it's a little less glamorous than that.
Oh,
I mean, the whole issue is dedicated to placemaking. So the whole issue is about public art in cities and the role of public art in cities and. What is the national trend toward placemaking all about? My particular article was a subsection of that issue, and it was specifically looking at the grants, the national grants that are supporting placemaking initiatives, and what is the thinking around it. So I went and talked to the grantors, found out what their priorities and what their interests are.
I can see why people subscribing to Public Art Review would be very interested in that topic.
Yeah, and then I talked to some people who've received grants and how it's affected their work and what they do, and then I've talked to some policymakers about and some artists who raise concerns about the placemaking grants.
Yeah, actually, so we talked about this a while ago when you were working on the article, and I was hoping you would kind of fill in we have about a dozen listeners, so fill in the dozen listeners' minds what placemaking is. Where does that term come from?
Well,
and how did that get started to be? It's kind of a catchphrase now. People often use it a little bit derisively, or I don't know, like... It's become one of those words that you put in grant applications when you want to sound like you know what you're talking about or like you're very contemporary, right?
Yeah. Well, it's
for some people.
It's hard to answer that in a short snippet.
It has something to do with Richard Florida, though, right?
It has a lot to do with Richard Florida, although the idea of placemaking goes way back.
Right.
You know, in the 60s and 70s, I think. Even before that, but I think in the 70s there were a lot of public artists who talked about placemaking. But I think the idea of what they were talking about was somewhat different about what the current conception is about. So I'll just talk about the current concept. And it really does develop out of Richard Florida. And Richard Florida, who was in the early 2000s, wrote some books about the creative class.
Right.
This idea of these types of citizens that were producers of culture, that they were, you know, they're artists, they're
people like
designers,
you and me, Michael.
Yeah, thinkers, writers, you know, basically underpaid people to a degree. I'm joking.
No, you're not.
but I mean, he was looking at these people and how they drive growth in cities and how they are incubators for a lot of things that are good about cities.
Right, right.
And he did some data crunching. There's been a lot of criticism since that time, since 2002, about the data that he used. And in fact, he did the work at Carnegie Mellon University, which was
in Pittsburgh.
In Pittsburgh, which was where I went in the mid 2000s.
Oh, no kidding.
I went to do a master's degree in public policy.
Yeah.
In arts management.
Yeah. And
the public policy
since then,
school.
He's been drummed out of the country and he's fled to Toronto. If I recall.
Well, no, he's climbing the ladder of fame and fortune.
Yeah,
is actually what he's doing.
That's true.
But he, you know, there was a lot of derision at Carnegie Mellon about the work he did because he was somewhat selective in his use of data.
Yeah, I remember reading that book when it came out, or actually years after it came out, because I'm kind of behind the times, and I really wanted to believe what he was saying. Like,
yeah.
First of all, it's very complimentary towards Minnesota.
Yeah,
he talks about places that have a lot of social capital, a cultural capital, where certain cities are doing a lot for the creative class, and the Twin Cities come out real nice. And then
it's a compelling argument. It's something you really want to believe,
right?
That artists and creative people and people that live in an alternative lifestyle help drive vibrancy in a city and bring people into the city.
You said vibrancy.
Yeah,
that's
vibrancy.
The other catchphrase.
Another buzzword, but
yeah.
And which comes out of this debate actually.
Yeah.
But
I wanted to believe it because. And I do believe it in a way, but I wanted to believe it because giving money or funding arts and culture is to me a really good idea, just because I know a lot of artists and people who are broadly described as being culture people or creative people, right? And
yeah.
And they're all entrepreneurs and whatever and making a living somehow, scraping by with...
Well, there's some obvious intuitive things to that. And, artists are people that oftentimes go into blighted regions of a city. And we see this happening in Minneapolis and St. Paul, in Lower Town St. Paul, in the Warehouse District in the 90s, in Northeast Minneapolis in the early 2000s.
So is there something about being an artist that is inherently urban?
I think so, yeah, because an artist needs a following. They need a public. They need the resources that artists, you know, of thought and creativity that come in a city.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, and then they also need cheap space, so which is why they oftentimes are the sort of the urban pioneers in sort of blighted areas. And then there's that whole gentrification process that's happened. It happened in the Warehouse District. We used to be nothing
sure.
but empty, broken down warehouses.
Way back in the day.
Before the Target Center and before Target Field and all that stuff. You talk to people that were in the Twin Cities here, and they always talk about, the heyday of the 80s and how we got chased out of the Warehouse District. And
chased out by money, by police.
Yeah, by developers, essentially.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of an obvious thing. You see that happen. You say, artists are a driver of vibrancy in a city. But the criticisms with Richard Florida often have to do with, you know, is it chicken and egg? Do cities draw artists because they're cities, or do artists build cities because they're artists and creative? You know, so it's really ill defined what a creative class does in a city, and there are lots of cities that, you know, are very vibrant but didn't really score high on his scale. You know, like New York City, which is the most, you know, fantastic artistic mecca
there's a few artists there.
But in his scale it didn't score very high, so you know, I mean, it's I don't know what the truth is, but it was an interesting idea. You fast forward about 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, when did that book come out? The
Creative Class. That was 2002, I think, is when it came out, and I remember reading it when it first came out. And there was a lot of discussion, and for a lot of time, you know, he became a star.
Sure he did.
He became a star in urban development circles.
You know, Michael, he retweeted me one time.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
well, he should. That's good. What did you say?
I forget. It was something. It was something about vibrancy.
Yeah. Well, he's very engaged, and he reacts to criticisms too. That there was a magazine that was published here that published a lengthy refutation of his theories just a few months ago.
Sure. Yeah, I remember
reading
that.
And he responded to that.
What was that? 32 Revolver. 32. 32.
Yeah. 32 magazine.
Right.
Yeah. 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 And yeah. Frank Burris wrote a long criticism of Richard Florida, and he responded at length.
Yeah, I read that article.
Yeah.
It was really interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
About Madison and how placemaking can only do so much, right? You can't, creative class sort of approaches, which often end up being like building a museum or what else kind of things do you do to attract the creative class?
Policies to attract creative class? That's one question.
They group a whole bunch of things that are kind of appealing to young urban professionals or young people.
Well,
like a bike lane often gets put in this conversation, right?
Yeah. Biking, I think at the time biking wasn't part of what he was looking at. He was often looking at you have to have...
Tolerance of gay people.
Tolerance of gay people is a big thing, yeah. It was very interesting. And I, you know, it's a lot of it is sort of based on your perspective. He was living in Pittsburgh at the time.
Yeah.
Which, Pittsburgh's a great city, but it doesn't have a vibrant urban gay nightlife. Whereas Minneapolis does. It does not. Does not. I lived there for a year.
Okay.
Does not. And Minneapolis does. And so Minneapolis scores high on the scale. Apparently Madison does as well. I don't know. Madison scored very high on his scale. And then that was part of the reason why Frank Burris went there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he said, you know, this, he had the hardest time there. It wasn't a creative place for him. It wasn't what he expected. And I think it's a lot about expectations. You know, when you're looking at, you're trying to make broad generalizations about something so abstract like creativity and how it affects the urban reality, and using data sets and trying to extrapolate some sort of formula, and you're discounting a place like New York and you're building up a place like Madison, you're setting yourself up for people to criticize. So...
But on the other hand, you're becoming very famous. City rankings formulas are always like this, too. Like,
that's
Minneapolis
right.
is like the whatever, fourth most literate city in America
Second
or whatever.
Second best biking city.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know. I saw your blog post on that. That was very good.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, I get driven crazy by those things, too. And you know, I think everyone has their own reality about where they live and what they value. You know, and, you know, somebody may go to Austin, Texas, which is another place that scores high on these kinds of scales, and say,
and I've been there. It's nice.
Yeah, but, you know, so much of your reality is based on, you know, your personality, or who you meet, you know, exactly what you want to practice as a creative person, and so on and so forth. You know, I think there's a lot of truth in what Richard Florida wrote, but, you know, it's so sweeping. That and it ushered him to the top echelon of urban thinkers and urban development thinkers, and you know whether or not he's worthy of that, I don't know, but it opens up to a lot of criticism because it's so sweeping and so sort of I don't know.
The other criticism I heard about creative class stuff is just that it focuses on attracting kind of wealthy white young people, right? Basically, that's who you're talking about, and. And so a city will then devote a lot of resources to that instead of, like, funding education for everybody or transit for everybody or whatever.
It's,
and it's part of this kind of era of privatization and segregation of different populations. And so, I don't know.
I think racial diversity was one of his key factors.
Okay.
But when you're talking about the creative class, like he's talking about, you are talking about... middle class and upper class white kids mostly, you know, because it's just not the reality for most you know, urban kids of color, you know, that to think about, I want to be an artist. They're thinking about, you know, how can I get a good, decent job and get a good, decent education in this kind of school district I'm in? You know, it does sort of preclude that kind of diversity, I think. And that's been a lot of the I think you're right. It's a lot of the criticism. And then, to go back to my experience in Carnegie Mellon, I asked about him when I was there, and the people there were, you know, a lot of them were sort of shrugged him off. And I think maybe there was a little bit of professional jealousy because he had moved on by then. But also, you know, they just questioned his data and his what he was doing with his data. And since then, in say about 6 or 7 years after he published, because he published, I think, a follow-up and tried to explain his data a little bit better.
Yeah.
But some other academics took his ideas and really did try to test and it's the thesis and really try to hone in on what he was talking about. One of them is actually located here, a Humphrey School person, Ann Markison.
Sure, I know her.
Yeah, and so Ann Markison was key in the she kind of picked up with a lot of what he was doing. I think she was starting at the same time doing research in the same field and looking at data at cities and doing some studies. And I think about 2 years ago she published a study about creative placemaking. In fact, she was the one who defined the current term, which is not just placemaking, it's creative placemaking as the term. So it's evolved into this idea, and I think it's taking that creative class thing, and it's trying to suggest that it is possible to affect your urban environment, affect the vibrancy of a city by bringing together artists and creative people and sort of creative organizations and enterprises to change the place in some way, to make a new vision of what a place is, to go to a region and develop it through the arts, through creativity. And so, you know, she had done the study and followed a bunch of projects around the country and looked at data and this is what has driven this movement to grant funding of creative placemaking projects.
Now I need to read her book.
It's a white paper. It's about,
I think I've read that,
50 pages, I think,
it.
Or so.
Yeah.
You know, the
I need to read it more carefully.
The core of it is probably about 10 pages, and then there's like 40 pages of case study examples.
Yeah.
It's pretty simple. I mean, it's actually kind of disappointing because I don't know that there is a lot of real hard data other than experiential sort of, here's what's happening in Austin, Texas. Here's what's happening at this project here and here and here. But, at the time, my personal theory, which I didn't really talk about it because this was a short article on just kind of surveying the grant trend, is this idea has been percolating just at the time when we had a major economic downturn. We had a lot of pressure on the stock market and a lot of corporations having trouble.
Yeah, so grants in general, arts funding
dying.
In general has been going
a lot of nonprofits going out of business. And so come around 2010, you had policymakers saying, what can we do to spur investment in creative projects while still, I think I need to have a sip.
Yeah, I think you do.
I'll keep things going.
We're drinking
going.
Summit, by the way. Summit, what is this 140? It had
old,
a number.
Old 152.
Old 152. We didn't get an explanation of what that is.
No.
It's good, though. I like it.
It's very hoppy.
Yeah.
I'm just getting over a cold.
So. Oh, I'm sorry.
Can we press pause here for a moment?
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's fine. All 12 of the listeners, I have long attention spans. We're, by the way, at Sweeney's in St. Paul on Dale Street, right in the corner of the bar, looking out at windows as the sun is starting to go down here on a nice afternoon. It warmed up today.
So we actually, we had this all coming together at the point when we had an economic downturn. a lot of pressure on nonprofit organizations. And then a new president, Barack Obama, came into power in 2008. And remember that.
I remember that. He got reelected recently.
He got reelected recently, just a few days ago, actually. But he, you know, of course, what happens in that moment is you a chance to look at arts giving and arts, the federal arts focus, and how to address that on a national level. And he actually hired a guy who was instrumental in the creative placemaking process, Rocco Landsberg, who was the new chairman of the NEA, and acting under the initiative of the president, started looking at ways to leverage more limited funds, but make things happen. And creative placemaking on the granting level is very much about bringing partners together to change the city or parts of the city using the arts and other components. So it's about collaboration and cooperation. It's about addressing space and place in the city, and using the arts to address change in those places, and using arts organizations and artists in collaboration with funders and businesses in collaboration with city governments. So it's an interesting idea, and it makes sense in our times when we have limited resources. But it also is just a result of this long sort of percolation of the idea that artists can change a city. That's my long answer to the question, what is creative placemaking?
That's a long answer, Michael.
Yeah.
But it actually, what you're saying just now reminds me of, I've been in graduate school in geography, the geography department, for a long 6 years now. I think 6 years now. And I've been learning a lot about the history of kind of what the concept place refers to, because it's this term that probably dates back to Heidegger in the 1930s, but and 1920s, but has became in vogue in kind of social science and geography in particular in the early 70s. There was a guy at the U of M actually named Yifu Tuan who wrote a number of books about concept of place as opposed to space. Space being like everything is kind of equal and abstract and filled with stuff, and there's stuff in this abstract Cartesian kind of emptiness, and you can kind of quantify it very easily, versus place being something that is related to how we remember things and how we experience things in our particular sort of trajectories as human beings. And I don't know, it's kind of a philosophical argument about the fact that you can feel really close to something even though it's really far away, and vice versa, and that the experience of distance is really subjective and it's not easily measurable and quantifiable, and we should start thinking about that. Yeah. So that's my short, really terrible version of what place refers to in kind of a philosophical sense. But that started becoming important in urban theory and urban planning in the 60s after people like William White and Jane Jacobs started writing a lot about it. And one of the ways that this concept of place versus space manifests itself in urban planning is the idea that you can walk a mile in Manhattan or you can walk a mile in Maple Grove. And they can Mendota Heights, actually, where you live and where I'm from. And it can feel very, very different. The mile, yes, in Manhattan can feel like no time at all went by. Like you're just very excited and engaged, and so the perception that you're having in that mile of walking is actually really exciting, and no time has passed, and you can walk another mile, you'd be not bored at all, and your perception of the time and the distance are very small compared to if you walk a mile in Mendota Heights, it'll be like the Bataan Death March, and you'll basically you'll be begging for water. You'll be like the guy in the desert in the movie from the 60s, the really long one. Whatever, I can't think of his name. Lawrence of Arabia. Yeah, D.H. Lawrence. Not D.H. Lawrence.
I'm not seeing it, but yeah.
You know, he's begging for water. It's okay. That's what it feels like to walk a mile in Mendota Heights, is my point. And that's because space
spoken
and place
like
are
not
the
same thing. Spoken like a true suburban refugee.
Yeah, space is a mile in both cases, but the place feeling of it is very different. There's so many people and so much to do and see, and all the little spots you're going through are meaningful when you're in a vibrant place-filled city.
Sure.
Every street corner has a name and a history and a legacy, and there's activity there, and it means something to a lot of people living nearby.
Yeah.
And that's the concept of space, and the trajectory of that goes way back 50 years or 100 years into the depths of kind of what it means to be in a city, right? So, yeah. But what you're saying is that in the last few years, this has really coalesced and become something that people can really start using. And I've noticed that, too, just in writing about the Twin Cities and in collaborating with art friends that I have around town. Like, more and more, it seems like the arts community and the urban planning community, or whatever you want to call it, the urbanism community, have a lot in common and have a lot of common interests and common agendas and common goals and common locations where we're doing interesting work about, I don't know, what it means to have a sidewalk in front of your house or I can think of a bunch of examples. So, yeah, where do we go from here with placemaking?
Well, and there's a lot of things going on with it. I mean, it's very new on a national granting level. It's been about 2 years since they've really initiated these grants. They're in the there's two main organizations that are doing it nationwide. There's the NEA, which has its Our Town grants, and then there's a consortium of foundations that call themselves Art Place, mm-hmm. which actually was sort of brought together through the NEA, but it's a separate entity, and they're both in their third year of granting projects. The Twin Cities have been very successful in getting some of the initial grants, and these are grants on the level of $150,000 to $250,000.
Like, what are some examples?
Well, the big one that a lot of people talk about is the Irrigate Arts, which is the Central Corridor arts project, which created sort of ad hoc public art projects to keep the public connected with local businesses. So they would go into, you know, as the Central Corridor was being built and the light rail line was going down University and everything was shut down, the businesses that were on the sidewalks, you know, behind the sidewalks, were struggling. So this group of artists that got this grant money spearheaded a bunch of projects to bring public into businesses a lot of times.
Do you think that it actually worked?
I don't know. You know, I'm not super familiar with the... with the results, and that's actually where I was going with this, is that one of the big things now is the assessing the value of these grants. They're brand new grants, brand new projects, brand new thinking about what is the role of arts in urban development. And so the question now is, how do you assess the success of them?
Yeah,
I mean, I hear about projects a lot. I haven't been to a lot of them because, well, for one, I live in Mendota Heights, but the other, I'm a father of a young child, so I don't get out as much as I used to. But I hear about them a lot, and I know there's a lot of buzz about them. I hear anecdotally that businesses, some of the projects were so successful that the businesses that are on the Central Corridor wanted to keep artists in place. So they may have done a little mural in the window or something.
A mural is an example.
Or had a performance. I think there was one place that had... an artist come in and do sort of a cabaret performance, and they decided people came in and loved it. Let's do this even beyond the scope of this Irrigate Arts project.
Yeah.
That's a question for the project coordinators to decide and to assess the success of moving forward. And on a national level, there's a lot of talk now about, and that was one of the things I wrote about in the article, how do you assess? How do you assess something so abstract as urban vibrancy or place, like you were just talking about? I mean, that's difficult to assess, especially when you're looking at, and we talked about this article from this Next American City blog, right?
Yeah.
You know, how do you assess when you're looking at different urban perspectives? Because I was thinking as you were talking about space and place and how a mile in Mendota is like walking
actually,
through.
Actually, Mendota is really cool, so don't say that about
Mendota Heights. No, okay, Mendota Heights. A mile in Mendota Heights walking through is like walking through the Sahara Desert versus New York, which is like walking through Candyland or something.
Yeah. It's just in terms of diversity.
But and, yeah. I would argue that it's also, I mean, you also have to look at urban perspective because different people come from different perspectives. Somebody like me who has a three-year-old child who likes the open trails of Mendota Heights, and I can take my child out on the trails.
That's nice to say, but walk a mile.
Has a different perspective. I love New York too, but I'm just saying, if you look at like urban communities of color or people from a depressed urban background,
right.
How what they might take in on walking a mile in New York may be very different to what we might take in as privileged white people.
So I get your point, but I challenge you to walk a mile up to Delaware Avenue.
Right.
Okay.
I have not done that. I usually walk into the forest.
Yeah, of course you do.
But my point is that's what this writer Neera Mehta is talking about is how do we assess the value of these projects that are maybe not really addressing the concerns of real people in the urban centers.
Right.
And this is the bigger concern is when you're putting federal dollars and big money into projects to change the urban landscape and putting things on the street or in buildings or on windows of buildings that a lot of people who are depressed and busy and going to a difficult job and trying to make ends meet may not even notice. You know, I think what they're talking about is we just really need to assess how much is this really changing and improving the lives of cities. And vibrancy is such a shaky term. You know, I just was reading before I got here, there was a tweet I just saw from
is so the current idiom, isn't it?
And it's great. But the director of Art Place, whose name is escaping me, I can pull it up actually, tweeted about an article. There's, you know, a discussion between her and Anne Markeson about just this issue. Can we measure vibrancy? The Art Place says that they can. Anne Markeson, who set off this whole thing with her creative placemaking white paper, says, how can we measure our vibrancy? We need to have better terms. We need to have better data.
I think it's the number of people walking. That's vibrancy, and that's the end of the story.
Well, there you go. Carol Coletta is the name of the director of Art Place, and you can follow her on Twitter at Art Place America.
I'll add her to my Twitter.
You should. There's a lot of organizations that have popped up. Whenever you throw federal dollars, significant federal dollars at something, there's a lot of things that pop up within 2 years.
Michael. Yeah, that's a coincidence. I don't know what you're reading into that. But yeah, you're right. Follow the money.
Yeah. You know. Well, I mean, it's not huge amounts of money in the scheme of things. You know, they've dedicated like $10 million, but in the arts,
that's federal. That's a federal policy for $10 million.
Yeah.
That's not anything. And that's my point about artists is that we'll work for cheap, right?
Yeah.
So if you, I'll have a summit, please.
Yeah. I'm doing okay. Thanks. We have a tap too.
Okay, good.
Super.
Yeah.
So thank you, podcast audience. That was a riveting moment.
Beer. But $10 million will only get you so far with like certain groups of people. But for artists,
like the Vikings, for example.
Yeah, I mean that hires you one defensive back or something. I don't know what it is.
Or apparently two or three seats in the stadium.
I just been reading
the licensing
about this.
Fee. Yeah, ridiculous.
Yep. So $10 million will get you a tiny portion of a Viking stadium, or it will support thousands of people who work for peanuts, mm-hmm. who are working artists.
Raise their profile, establish their career.
For whom a tiny bit of subsidy or money, you know, through a grant program or through anything, makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
And And that's basically the,
Tell that to Paul Ryan.
But I forget where I why I brought this up.
It was follow the money.
Oh yeah, that's right. Well, yeah. So.
Well, yeah. So it's been, and it's interesting because now in my new job, of course, being aware of this move, and also having issues related to our space, we are in the hunt for placemaking money ourselves.
Uh-huh,
so
sure.
It is it's a hell of a lot of work. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
On a practical level of trying to bring together the partners. I mean, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, you get maybe $150,000. The amount of work you have to do to make that stuff happen.
That's the other thing about grant writers that I know about.
Yeah, it's...
I guess what I remember that I wanted to say, Michael, was about the Central Corridor Project and this question about... It's already a very tense issue for a couple of reasons. The invasiveness of the light rail and the fact that it's perceived as being for people who aren't in that neighborhood already, right?
Right.
For people who are...
Because it's a very diverse neighborhood.
Yeah.
And
So
local artists are not necessarily a hugely diverse group.
Right. And this is a common problem, or it's a common narrative anyway, that artists are people who come in from outside and they make something and they bring in all their friends and they have a little party in your neighborhood and then they leave and there's some money that funded it and what are you left with? And the question is, who's the ones that the art is for? Is it for the people in that neighborhood, or is it for... developers who are going to come in and improve the area by, you know, building some fancy new housing that will cater to a group of people. I don't know. That's the question. And I felt that tension during this tour that I helped with some public art stuff for the Central Corridor, where it felt almost colonialist that we were going into this kind of poor neighborhood where I happened to live near there, but most of the other people didn't live anywhere close to there. And we're just walking through looking for artistic things happening and things we could turn into art for kind of consumption by others. I don't know. That's the question that
well,
I have.
I think that's a good question, although I think that this project was specifically geared towards the businesses.
Yeah, okay.
That were located, and they wanted to help. They wanted to bring arts to create a sense of place and activity and vibrancy when businesses were going to be essentially being forced to go dark somewhat. They wanted to help shore up some of the businesses. So I think that it's been successful on the level where it's connected artists and art projects with businesses, and a lot of the businesses are minority-owned. And serve minority or serve a...
And they can use all the advertising that they, you know, anything you can do to get people to put University Avenue and Frogtown on their map.
And so in a sense, this was a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
My question about it is the lasting value, and I think that's my personal question about Irrigate is... it's temporary, so you're throwing a lot of federal dollars at something that's temporary. It helps shore up, it doesn't completely, but it helps shore up businesses and the street life of a region for a short time. But at the end of the day, what have we created of lasting value?
Yeah.
That's what I wonder about. I don't know if that question's really been addressed in these grants and the thinking around these grants. To me, if you talk about vibrancy of a city and you have something that lasts a short time in that city and you're talking about memory of place, how do you really assess the value of your dollars? And that's what grant makers have to do. They have to say, if we're giving you a certain amount of money to do something, how much lasting value do we create?
This is a problem. So what I'm studying right now with my research is the non-motorized transportation federal grant that the Minneapolis got. It was $25 million for bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure over a long period of time, a number of years, to kind of fund different things, bike infrastructure, bike lanes, the Nice Ride program, a bunch of outreach. But assessing this stuff is really difficult.
Yeah.
One of the catches with part of the funding was, okay, come back to Congress and give us an assessment of the progress you've made. But it's almost impossible because it took years and years and years to even figure out which projects would get funded. And even after they're funded, how do you evaluate them? Because it takes years for people to start seeing, oh, hey, there's a great bike route right near my house. Now I'm going to change my... I'm going to buy a bicycle. How long does that take? You know, so you don't see results of these things for years in the distance. Yeah. With art, it's so much more diffuse, too.
Yeah.
If you...
I can see it would be very similar in a lot of ways.
If you put sculptures up, or if you put a mural up, or if you have events at a periodic basis in a place, and you start kind of... I don't know. It takes a long time for that to have any sort of effect, and if it does, it's going to be almost impossible to quantify.
Yeah.
So it's a problem for grant writers or for people doing, for engineers or policymakers, right?
Yeah.
How do they make a case that this is... So you end up having to make up statistics like Richard Florida does, right? You have to, like, manufacture some results.
Well, he didn't make up results. It's just about how you interpret...
No, he picked and choose some nice
ones.
How
you interpret the statistics, yeah, and what it means.
Well, what's the lies, damn lies, and statistics? Those are the three categories of falsehood. Have you heard that quote before?
Yes, of course. How's that? Lies, damn lies, and statistics.
I don't know who said that, though.
Yeah, I don't know. it's an important thing, but it is a squishy. The fact is, urban experience is a squishy thing. You're never gonna. It's not like baseball, or like presidential elections, where you can have Nate Silver come along and say, "I can examine the assumptions of every poll. I can weight polls appropriately. I can take the bulk of the data, and I can give you a pretty clear prediction on what's going to happen in the election." And people go, "Oh my God, how did he do that?" Well, it's about voting at the end of the day, and voting
it's
is
about
a really
polling at the end of the day.
Well, I mean, it's about the vote. The vote is a very clear data set.
Yeah,
it's either you vote for one guy or the other.
And the at bat is a very clear data
set. Yeah, and getting a hit, getting on base is a very clear data set. Experiencing art or experiencing the city, experiencing place is not... You have so many assumptions about that you have to take into account. There's no way... what even is the data that you measure? I like the city or I don't? Mm-hmm. I like to go this place or I don't? I mean, how do you even begin to assess it? I don't know. It's an interesting conundrum, and more and more with limited dollars, people want that. They want that clarity, but they're not going to get it because there's no clear base hit at the end of the day, is there?
No, you just ruined baseball for me. No, you didn't. What? Do you think this is just a fad? This is what I'm worried about, and I hope it's not true. But you know how, I don't know, for a while, urban malls were the next big thing, and then they turned out Blocky was a disaster, and then, I don't know, urban planning and cities are very susceptible to kind of trendy thinking, right? And so one of the worries of me and some others is that placemaking is just the next thing that grant writers are putting in that fill in the blank, that Mad Lib they have to do to kind of try to get money for their neighborhood.
Yeah. Well,
you think this is just a trend that's gonna be replaced in the future by something else?
Yeah.
Smart cities, sustainability. That was a little while ago, right?
Yeah.
Now we're on to.
It is obviously just a trend.
It's not obvious because I don't want that to be true, man. I want art and urban kind of critical urbanism to come together.
It is just a trend, and the thing is, will it evolve into something similar? Will it affect thinking going forward? We can't predict. I mean, we can't, like Blocky. Nobody could predict the fact that that Netflix was going to kill theater going, for the most part. I mean,
isn't what brought that down.
Yes, it's true.
Because it was like the last thing standing, that and the cookie store.
Yeah.
And the Shout House, which is terrible.
All I'm saying is that we have no idea what's going to happen and what will change in our thinking, you know. So it is going to be just a trend. Something else will come along. Whether or not it's going to change cities to the point where if it goes away, the city will be blighted, I don't know. I mean, some of the urban trends through the last 50 years have damaged cities.
I don't think skyways.
Yeah, well, skyways, the freeway construction,
monorail.
But you name it. I mean, you could look at any different urban trend over the last 60 years and say, yeah, that was doomed. Yeah, that was doomed. Yeah, that was doomed. This is different, though. This isn't really changing the face of what cities are. It's kind of trying to address the way that we interact and people with creative abilities interact with the city and have a say in what cities do and what they are. You know, no artist is going to come along and say, hey, let's cut off the entire Rondo neighborhood here with a freeway and kill this neighborhood.
And tear down 4,000 houses.
Yeah, you know, that's not what's happening.
Actually, I can think of some artists that might say that. Vito Acconci comes to mind.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I don't know. He's actually really cool.
He would do that on a lark. But, I mean, they're talking about real serious issues of what's specific to a place and how can we address it as creative people. And, you know, they're not talking about changing the entire structure of the city.
Yeah.
So I don't think, I mean, it's obviously it's going to be a trend. It may evolve into something similar or different that builds off it, or it may completely change when we get Mitt Romney Jr. as president or whatever.
Tag Romney.
Yeah, whatever
Taggart,
it is.
You know, Taggart.
These things come and go. They're affected by policy thinking on the higher levels and... You know, and then it'll switch back another 5-10 years, whatever. My hope is that this continues and that this develops and it becomes better and it makes cities better without really locking us into a crazy, you know, structural
moment. Yeah, the amount of money they spend on the Viking Stadium, if they put that much money into the local arts community, I don't know, what would happen? We'd all turn into Darth Vader.
Oh, I wouldn't want it to happen. I think
no, that would be terrible.
That would be terrible because then that would put too much spotlight on the arts community. I don't think the arts community could handle it. I mean, it's what would you do with that much money?
Walker would take all the money. And then
Walker would take it. Well, look what happened with the legacy money.
Sure.
I mean, all the big corporate, pseudo corporate organizations.
Tell my friends who work for NPR and the Walker. And yeah. Godfrey, I apologize.
They took the bulk of the money. So
yeah.
It didn't really, it didn't really affect the individual artists that much.
Before we end, because we're about to, Michael, will you put in a plug for the 13 Ways of Looking at Minneapolis?
Oh, sure. I've been at this organization, the Minneapolis Television Network, for 3 months, and we launched a new initiative. It's called the 13 Ways of Looking at Minneapolis Project. And it's essentially what we're doing is we're just opening up our channels for urban documentarians and filmmakers to send us stuff to show on air. But we're trying to get a little bit of seed money to make the infrastructure work. We have some plans of how to do that. We also want to screen the best of these documentaries. We need a computer dedicated to this purpose for live streaming these documentaries. You know, there's just a lot of creative talent here, as we've been talking about. And there are venues and places that are set up to give a place for these creative people to come and do what they do. So we want people to come and tell the story of Minneapolis on our channels. And in the meantime, before we launch that effort to start collecting documentaries, we have a little Indiegogo project. It's going to be running...
Indiegogo.
Indiegogo is basically the more non-profit-y version of Kickstarter.
Okay.
So Indiegogo.com. Go to Indiegogo. Indiegogo.org. Sorry.
.org.
Type in 13 ways of looking at Minneapolis and donate $5 to our project and help us get this off the ground. We just want to get a little seed money to give local artists a chance to tell the story of Minneapolis.
There's no better way to spend $5.
Yes.
From an,
or $100.
Or $100.
Whatever you have.
Yeah. Just look in your wallet.
Yeah. Whatever's available. Hey, it's the price of a beer.
Speaking of which, let's finish these
ones. Let's finish these
off. Okay, thanks a lot for talking to me, Michael.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's really fun.
It was fun.
Listening to the Streets.mn podcast. If you have any feedback or ideas, you can comment on Streets.mn on Twitter at StreetsMN or email me at blindeke@gmail.com. So long from St. Paul's Cathedral Hill.